nobody's going to come earlier because we don't start. So, we'll bring this meeting to order. For those of you who aren't familiar with the permanent school trust lands, there is a council that theoretically oversees the management of the permanent school trust funds. They're essentially managed by DNR, but there is an advisory council that tries to oversee some of this. And when we met last fall, we talked about how we might begin to up the amount of money that comes into the trust lands from the permanent school trust lands that comes into that trust, so that there would be more money available for distribution to schools each year. It really doesn't produce a lot of money for us. It does produce some. It doesn't amount to a large item in any school's agenda or in any school's financial accounting, I should say. But we are going to, we talked then about how we might increase the dollars, some of the things that might be done. We talked about the Boundary Waters because the state was never paid for all those acres that went into Boundary Waters. And so we will go ahead here. I'm sorry some of these people aren't hearing this because all of our freshmen have never heard this presentation, actually, and aren't familiar with the permanent school trust lands. But let's go ahead. Let's see, who's starting here? Who is going to be the beginning? Are you, Bill? All right. Is it Mr. Carroll? All right. And I think you all have a copy of the latest biennial report on the Minnesota School Trust Lands, which will show you kind of how we're doing in the last biennium and the biennium before that. Ah, the Deputy Commissioner has arrived.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Pardon me. Commissioner Holston, you used to be one of us. And I keep forgetting that you've moved way up the ladder.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Mark Holston, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I apologize.
I got
a bus to run over to the Capitol for
My folks are very late, so you don't have to apologize.
Are you ready to begin?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, in the area of the Minnesota School Trust Lands, the Department of Natural Resources is the managing entity within the state of Minnesota for those lands, and we take that responsibility very seriously. In fact, I think you'll notice in the from a lot of the discussions that, Madam Chair, that you brought to the office, to the Commissioner's office, and concerns and some of the concerns that we've heard in the legislature over the last couple of years, Commissioner Merriam and myself are very interested in the school trust fund lands and how we manage them. And I think within the department, you will see an increased notice of that. And we take that management very seriously and are beginning to change some of our practices.
And we appreciate that very much. Thank you.
But with that, I have Bill Bryce, who's the director of our Lands and Minerals Division, and Mike Carroll, who's the director of our Forestry Division, who ultimately manages the lion's share of those lands for the economic development. So I will turn this over to them and then be available for questions after. But I'd have these two gentlemen provide.
All right.
Background.
Who's starting? Mr. Carroll?
Mr. Bryce.
Mr. Bryce. Okay.
Don't touch that.
I knew I'd guess much.
What does this button do?
Don't touch it. Madam Chair, members, my name is Bill Bryce, and I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals. And what we'd like to talk to you about today are basically an overview of the school trust lands. We want to show you a little about the lands that we own, a little about some facts about how they're managed currently, some information about what the duties of a trustee are in a situation like this, some information on the revenue generation and distribution, and finally we want to talk about some opportunities that we and some issues that are out there that have been quite popular as possible a future for income, and then also some issues that have been quite difficult for the department to deal with. This is a map of the school trust lands, and if by the way, I should mention, each of you have a handout, and the handout has this a PowerPoint presentation in it, so the map is too small to read. Your presentation should be attached to the book, or with the book. There's two handouts there. That's the PowerPoint presentation, and then as we go through this, we'll refer to the book at various points along the way. So basically, this is the school trust lands that still exist in the trust fund today. Today, there's about 2.5 million acres of surface lands and about 1 million acres of additional mineral lands. If you go back to the beginning, basically it was a practice in England for colonial governments to set aside certain lands for the schools. And that happened in the United States as well as other places. When Minnesota was created as a territory in 1849, Section 16 and 36 were set aside for school purposes and reserved for the territory. And then when we became in the Abilene Act in 1857, when we became a state, that land was granted to the new state for use in the schools. And then the land was either sold or disposed of, when the land was sold or disposed of, in other words, 16 and 36 no longer existed as a piece of federal land, such as in southern Minnesota, where a lot of it had previously been homesteaded, then we received alternate lands for that purpose. And those lands, you'll hear the term indemnity school trust. Those are lands that we received in place of Section 16 and 36. So basically, if you go through all the townships in the state, we received a very large amount of land, about 2.9 million acres in that first grant. We received a second grant of swamp lands that was also dedicated to the school trust. And those lands were lands that were basically wet from the government surveys, and there was originally 4.7 million acres of land of that type. So if you add those two together, now we're at 7.6 million acres roughly. And then there was a third grant of lands. This is a grant for internal improvements, and that was about 0.5 million acres of land, and that too was dedicated to the schools. So if you add that all up, I can't remember the number, is it about 8 million acres, I think. 8.1, it's on my next slide. That's right. About 8.1 million acres was originally granted for school land. And some of it was retained, and some of it was sold, depending on the circumstances. And here's where we stand today. The original grants at 8.1 million acres, and today we have about 2.5 million acres still existing. And you saw the map at the beginning of the presentation. That map is also in the front of the biennial tax forfeited. Biennial trust fund reports that we recently completed. Back in the 1800s, initially the mineral rights were sold when the surface rights were sold, and up until about the late 1800s, mineral rights were not considered to be a especially important. But in 1889, there was a statute passed by the legislature that called for the reservation of mineral rights if the surface was to be sold. And that covered three counties, Cook Lake and St. Louis. And then a few years later, in 1901, that became a statewide statute. So over the years, since that time, about 1 million acres of surface land from the trust has been sold for various purposes, and the mineral rights have been retained. So in addition to the 2.5 million acres of surface land, we have an additional 1 million acres of mineral rights. If you were uh, If you were interested in knowing what counties all these mineral rights occur in, this gives you a pretty good summary. This is from the legislative auditor's report. Keeping these numbers up to date every time we give a talk is really challenging. So it's very close to being accurate, although it's probably not exactly the right number today because a number of years have gone by since we updated these numbers. But basically, you can see that Kuching and St. Louis County are the by far the two largest counties where school trust lands occur. And then it goes down the list to smaller numbers. Remember, the southern counties in the state were pretty much already settled when Minnesota became a state. There was a lot of previous folks out on the land, so 16 and 36 in the southern part was pretty much gone, and so we received alternative lands for those, and of course those tended to be in the northern part of the state where there were still lands available. So that's how we ended up with the county lands where they are today. If you look at the management by unit, you can see that most of the land is in state forests and campgrounds, about 1.7 million. About 85,000 are in wildlife management areas, about 51,000 in scientific and natural areas. Those are 100% in the peat scientific and natural areas. About 5,700 acres in state parks and so on. And then there's about 700,000 acres of land that are managed for forests but are outside of existing management units. And so that's pretty much the breakdown today as far as how the lands are distributed in management at the DNR.
Are there any questions to this point? Mr. Hyde, Representative Hyde-Gerken. God, I'm not awake today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rice, I have a question in regards to the setup, not the setup, but what has happened now in some of the sections 16 and 36 where the lands were set aside years ago. And especially in rural areas, at times these rural school districts dissolved, and in some cases, I'm not sure where the land went to. Did the townships take over the land? Did the farmers take over the land? What is happening there in regards to that property?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is
Mr. Bryce,
and so we manage this in trust for the school trust fund, and so it doesn't go to any individual school district, and the land is managed by DNR, and so any income from that then goes to the school trust, and then the income from that is what's distributed back to the school district.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hyde.
I have one particular township that comes to mind. I had a call on it last summer, and I did some checking into it. The school had dissolved, and the property's been farmed by a farmer. And the township now wants to take that piece of property over again because they feel it goes back to the township, and they want to build on that where it was designated for school. And the farmer's contesting. He's been taking care of this all these years. And the argumentation is, yeah, but you haven't been paying any taxes on it. So, I mean, that's where the township and this farmer's at, and it's actually in one of these properties that was set aside for a school. And the school actually was never built on this piece of property. It was built on another piece of property further up the road. So who's right and who's wrong in this?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
Representative, I don't know who's right and who's wrong. Okay. But it would be really good if you could give us the township range and the section, and we could look it up, and we could try to find out some more about that.
Thank you. I will do that.
Great.
But I haven't any idea. Normally schools weren't built on trust fund land. But there are a few examples of it around, and this could be an unusual circumstance.
Go ahead, Mr. Bryce.
Okay, I've found my place. So these next two or three slides are a couple of slides about some details about some of the categories in the last slide. I mentioned there are about 5,000 acres of land in state parks, and this is just the slide of those acreages in each of the parks and the distribution. And of course, we've been trying to exchange lands out of those parks, and that's something we probably should talk about. We completed an exchange in December for lands in Teteguch State Park and George Crosby Manitou. And you see on this, from this chart, George, there were no lands in George Crosby Manitou, but this is from the auditor's report, and there actually were some, and those have been exchanged out. But long term, I think it's an important issue that we should talk about, and we should also think about whether we really want to exchange all of these lands. For example, the Hill Annex State Park up there was a very large trust fund producer of income for many years, and there are stockpiles in that park that are of interest for mineral users, especially aggregate users today. And so I'm not sure that in all cases we should be exchanging out of all the parks, but that's just an example. So parks has been an issue for quite some time, and that's the status of where we're at on park management.
Mr. Bryce, at the time that these parks were formed with school trust land within them, was everybody aware that there were school trust lands in those, and was there any plan for how those would be handled in the future?
Madam Chair, I think up until about 1998 or so, there was a knowledge that there was land in the being put in the parks. There was always a perception that we would take care of it. And in fact, in the late 1980s, there was a series of exchanges that occurred that took care of quite a bit of that land. But then in the late 1990s, we quit putting trust fund land in state parks until we had solved the problem on that those parcels. And so from that point forward, we have not been doing that any longer, because obviously the problem just builds over time and doesn't get resolved.
Madam Chair. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still a little confused here. Okay. Originally, Section 16 and 36 had been set aside in the permanent school fund. And eventually that was handed off to the state land office, and eventually the DNR took over that department, right? My question is what happened to those properties in Section 16 and 36 that were set aside that were never used or are no longer being used for a school? What happened to those properties? If the state does not have them, who does have rights over those properties?
Well, Madam Chairman, Representative, originally, remember, there was, 9 million acres of these types of land out there. And today there's 2.5 million. That means that the majority of them were sold during the period from 1857 to most of them were sold up until about 1910 or 20. And then since that time, there has been less sales. So most of them were sold. The remaining lands have always been managed by the DNR, I believe, since the Department of Conservation was created. And I think that was around 1931, but I could be a little off on details on that. But and we, of course, have managed them ever since. Now, we didn't always get 16 and 36. We got only 16 and 36 where it was available. Mm-hmm. And so a large portion of our lands were not available, and we've got alternative lands for that.
Okay, thank you.
Our Representative Biskins had a question also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, to this slide. So is it my understanding that the 5,700 acres that are within parks generate no revenue for the school trust fund? Is that correct?
Currently, there is a small lease on Hill Annex, because that was a fairly recent state park to come into the system, and we have a plan that we've been working on with parks and the Historical Society to sell materials out of that park. I don't believe we get lease revenue on any of the other parks up there. And so there is no income on any of the rest of them at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So the next significant land piece I wanted to mention was the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. When the Boundary Waters Canoe Area was first created, of course, we owned our section 16 and 36 and a few other pieces of land in it. And unlike Voyageurs National Park, Voyageurs National Park, those lands were condemned out of the Voyageurs, and the lands became federal lands, and the state actually paid for those lands through a bonding issue. But in the Boundary Waters, there were many more acres than that. 87,000 is our best estimate. And so those lands continue to occur in the Boundary Waters, and there's been lots of discussion over the years on what exactly to do about that. Now I want to talk a little about the role of a trustee. The federal land grants have been reviewed by the courts, and the courts have concluded that these grants really did create a trust situation. And so in many of the western states, their state constitution explicitly acknowledges that a trust exists. However, in Minnesota's constitution, the word trust doesn't actually occur in the article on the permanent school fund. But it does occur for the land exchange article in the Constitution. And the word trust is found in Minnesota statutes and has always been considered a trust by the Minnesota courts. And so for those reasons, we consider this school trust land management trustee kind of relationship. The basic duties in the Constitution are to, if we sell the lands, to sell the school trust lands at public auction, and to deposit the revenue into the permanent school fund, which you'll hear about, and to distribute that income to the school district. That's what the Constitution basically says about the trust responsibility. The role of the trustee and The three groups that are mentioned up there are the ones that most frequently get mentioned as the responsible trustee, and that's the state legislature, the Department of Natural Resources, because we manage the lands, and the State Board of Investment, because they manage the fund. And so the three of us tend to be the three most prominent as trustees for this responsibility. Now, the duties of a trust manager are basically to do the following sorts of things. Use reasonable care and skill in their actions. Protect the property that's within the trust. Invest the trust assets properly and be loyal to the beneficiary. And those are the things that we as a group are supposed to be, are basically responsible for accomplishing. The basic questions that often get asked of a trustee, whether it's the state of Minnesota in school lands or any trustee in a bank or whatever, are these questions. Is it within my authority to perform the act of management that we're talking about? Do I have a duty to do that? And if I must act, how should I act? And then finally, if I have a choice, does my act of management serve the interests of the trust? And so those are kind of the rules that we go by when we think about this trust land responsibility. At this point, we want to talk a little about the revenue. And each of you have a trust fund report. That looks like this. And I'm going to be referring to some of the pages that are in there as we go through that. So. This is, incidentally, this is the second report that's been put out relative to the trust fund, and prior, and that was directly related to the auditor's report in 1997 or 96, suggesting that there ought to be frequent reviews of how the trust is being managed, and there ought to be written material on the results and so on. So We began doing that immediately after that auditor's report a few years ago. And if you go to page, bottom of page 2, you'll see that that's where the revenue portion of the report begins. And then it skips over to page 4. Now when revenue is received, and excuse me, page 5. When revenue is received in the school trust management lands, it has two routes. It either goes directly to the permanent school fund, or it goes through the forest expense account, and we'll talk about both of those today. The direct revenue goes are the two accounts are mineral leases and land sales, and you can see them up there on the board. For mineral leases, this is the report on mineral leases. In 2002, the income that went to the trust fund was about $4.7 million, and for 2003, the income was about $6.7 million. The difference between those numbers are a reason for the large difference. There are two reasons. One is that there was a grant program that the legislature approved that took a appropriation out of the 2002 count of about $865,000. So that reduced the 2002 number somewhat. But the other is a substantial increase in production on state trust fund lands at MNTAC. MNTAC is at Mountain Iron. It's the largest taconite operation on the range, and if you can, you can see the little squares up there on that map. You can see that those are the areas that we have school trust land in, and in fact, they moved into an area on the western end of the mine that was almost predominantly school trust land in a pretty big way in fiscal year 2003. So that was why the income increased dramatically. And if you look at that mine, you can see the black areas are the existing mine area, and then the purple, and then finally the green areas are future mining areas, and you can see that we will continue to get a fair amount of income out of that operation as long as they continue to operate up there and make money. They've had some financial problems lately, as have all the taconite operations, but currently everybody is making as many taconite pellets as possible, and they're all doing quite well. And that's a phenomenon that has occurred in the last 3 months, because way back in May, there were companies that were going bankrupt on the range, and now even those companies have started back up again. So very recently, that has changed, and that's great for both the trust fund and for the state and all the jobs.
Mr. Bryce?
Yes.
What is the availability of taconite in those areas? Is there, do you have any idea how much is available, how many years we can mine that and make income off of it?
Madam Chair, I don't know the ore reserves on that particular operation. We could certainly get it for you. But basically a good 40 acre parcel could have 30 to 40 million tons of ore on it. And so you saw, as you look over to the west there were quite a few 40s that probably have pretty good reserves. If they're too far north, they're going to have a little less than that. But that property, I think, has ore reserves for about 30 years, and we're a major participant in that for most of that time. And we'll also be a major participant in school trust further to the west. The other two properties that we have a school trust land is our HIPTAC over at Hibbing, and North Shore over at Babbitt. Those are the three properties that we have the most school trust land in. Now the next category here is land revenues, and again you can see the in fiscal year 2002 the land revenues amounted to about $860,000 and about $1.2 million in the fiscal year 2003. And those activities are basically sale of land, either through current sales or through past installment sales, contract for deed type situations.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bissons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, so I see that it's allowable to sell land. Can the Board of Trustees also purchase land as an investment?
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representative, we cannot in Minnesota, although there are other states who have done that and are doing that in the West, where they take a certain percentage of the income and they go out and purchase land in commercial areas or places like that. So it's being done as a trust management tool, but it's not allowed here in Minnesota.
Okay.
Does that mean we have a statute against it?
I think the statute is silent. It doesn't give us the authority, and so we don't have it without saying something affirmative.
Representative Biskins?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I guess that was my question. Is that they're lacking statutory authority, or is it constitutionally written where they could not purchase? But it sounds to me like it'd be statutory authority necessary.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's nothing in the Constitution that says one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much up to the legislature to determine what kinds of management direction we should have. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mike, and he's going to talk about the third type of income, which is the forest income.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Carroll. I'm the director of the Division of Forestry.
Mr. Carroll.
And our division is charged with the sustainable multiple-use management of the trust fund lands, and I'll provide for you an overview of the revenue. Again, I want to follow up on the committee chair's early statement. When I was the board chair of the Park Rapids School District, and as I spent hour after hour trying to figure out what my aid formulas were and where my money really came from, as a forester, I was at times very distraught with the actual number of dollars coming from timber revenue back to my particular school. But I was buoyed in my enthusiasm by the economic driver of these lands outstate. When you look at the multiplier effect, the jobs and the families that can support themselves, the haulers, the processors, the support jobs, and the actual kids in my school that benefited from the active management, forest management of these lands. The lands remain in public ownership. The timber grows back. The visual and wildlife values are protected and increased. We're using ecological classification systems, so we are charged very clearly with sustainable management of these lands. We have a very interesting formula for revenue generated from the lands, and I'll try to walk you through this. As you see by the Constitution, net revenue from school forests shall be used for such purposes designated by the state. And Minnesota Statute 16A-125 specifies which surface management costs can be certified against revenues from trust fund lands and how certified costs and net revenues are distributed. If you take your brochure, and I don't expect you to be experts today, but as you have additional questions, if you look at pages 12 through 14 in the biennial report, as you develop an expertise for these things and want further information, please feel free to give me a call and we can work through how we actually certify the cost. But what we are talking about in the revenue to forestry in slide 22, what we call a suspense account. The gross revenues from school trust fund land, revenues from timber sales, which are 80% of the money that goes into this account, sand and gravel leases, state forest campground receipts, and a few other small lease payments go into a forest suspense account. The money sits there. It's an interest-bearing account. The money sits there, and then we have to go in and annually document charges for management to that account. And I have on hand and can distribute to those that are interested how we actually go through and certify our management costs. We generate timber revenue. We then certify our costs. That goes through a very formal review process within the department and then also within the Department of Finance. And then certified forest management costs. The money, and I'll get to it as we go through the slides. They're a little bit out of order here, but as we go through the slide, as we certify our costs, the gross revenue minus the certified cost, that money then goes into the permanent school fund. The certified costs then go back to the general fund. So we have a stream of money going back to the general fund to offset the operations of my division, and then we come in annually and ask you for a general fund appropriation. But the net revenue does go to the permanent school trust, and then they determine how those monies are allocated. The next slide, we have it. If you look, we're talking about gross revenues here. Just to, by way of interest, in fiscal year 03, net return to the state of Minnesota from timber sales on all lands we manage as a state was approximately $18.5 million. Of that, 48% was trust fund lands, which generated the $8.9 million back into the trust thing. We then went ahead and certified our costs, and in the next couple of slides we'll show you what net return to the trust. But we're talking about 18,000 acres that are actually treated, we call it a treatment cost, that are harvested out of a 4.4 million base of all the lands we manage. 18,000 acres out of this 2.5 million of trust. So it's a small acreage, but it's sustainable forest management. We treat these acres. The return of about $35 a quart for the material harvested off of those lands, and you're talking about 14 quarts per acre, and you're talking about, if you're looking at the activity in 03 on trust fund lands, school trust fund lands, you're talking about 510 sales that the state administers. We go in, we treat the stands, we are removing fiber, we're trying to improve the wildlife and visual quality of those stands. We then either naturally regenerate or artificially regenerate those stands so it is sustainable forest management. But that gives you some idea in 03 how many acres, what we're talking about, cordage, and about 510 sales a year that actually affect trust fund land. So that goes into a gross revenue. The next slide will show you the pie chart. If there's questions, speak up.
Representative Hyde Gerken.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking on page 12 and 13, I'm looking at making a comparison between gross and net.
Yep.
And when I look under Apple 3, I'm looking at the leases bringing in 7.4 and the timber bringing 8.9 and the trust lands bringing 1.26. And when I look at the net, it's 6.7 for the you have minerals there, but just look at the forestry end of it, we have a 3.6 and a 1.2. Totally, we have just with forestry. When we look at the on page 12, I'm looking at 1560, about 17 million. And when I look at the net from the forestry, I'm looking at about 4 or 5 million.
That's correct.
Wow, there's a lot of loss in between.
It's not loss. It goes back to the general fund.
Goes back
it's
to general.
Certified cost, and I'll walk through that. I'll go through that for you. How we certify costs. If you look on page, as you walk through onto page 13, we go back and certify costs for annual fire protection. Forest roads cost is very small, and I'll give you, because you asked the question. We have a very formal process where we have to go in, look at the hours spent by our staff in managing trust fund land. What is related to timber sales, what is related to road maintenance, what is related to fire protection. And we go through a very detailed determination of costs for each fiscal year. Those costs are certified, basically pulled off the gross, and it goes back to the general fund so that they then can appropriate back to the Division of Forestry General Fund dollars per operation. So it is a lot of money, and they do certify a lot. The gross versus the net, but it's a very detailed, based on hour per hour work. It's a process that is closely watched not only by the department, but by the auditors and also by the Department of Finance. So we have those costs, and that's an excellent question. The Division of Forestry doesn't get those dollars. They aren't lost. They go back in. Those costs are certified from the revenue back into the general fund. That's an excellent question.
I think perhaps, Mr. Carroll, he meant they are lost to us.
Oh, okay. They are lost to the trust. I don't feel they're lost, but they are pulled off what you have as an investment fund, very clearly.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carroll, I don't know if I can ask as excellent a question as my good friend Representative Hyde Gerken, but my question is, does the DNR have the ability to swap land within its jurisdiction, i.e. Trust land with other DNR properties?
The answer is yes, but Bill seems to want to answer it, so go ahead.
Mr. Bryce.
I don't need to answer it. The example that I gave earlier about the school trust land in the two state parks, we completed that exchange, and it was for acquired forestry land. versus school trust land in Crosby, Manitou, and Teteguch State Park. We completed in December, so we have the ability to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then, Mr. Bryce, is there any statutory requirement to that? If you were to swap lands, that the land you are swapping into the permanent trust fund generate the same amount of revenues as the land you have swapped out of the trust fund? Is there any said requirement?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's no set requirement, but obviously the responsibility of a trust agent is to look exactly at that and make sure that the lands that you're getting actually is a positive for the trust. And so we try to look at that whenever we do a land exchange. In the case of the parks, of course, those lands were returning nothing to the trust, and the lands that we swapped for, we believe, will have some timber sales on them in the next few years. So we think that was a very positive exchange.
So, Madam Chair, I guess...
Representative Biskins.
So, Madam Chair, I guess then it's really important for us to make sure we have good school advocates on the Board of Trustees. Not that I don't think we currently do. I'm not saying that, but I just think it's our responsibility to always ensure that we have good school advocates on the board.
On which board are you referring to? The Oversight?
The Oversight Board, the Board of Trustees for the School Trust Fund.
Okay. Which actually what we have on that are two superintendents, I believe a rural and a metro area superintendent, the commissioner, the finance chair of the Senate and the Ways and Means chair of the House, and then the two education policy chairs from the House and Senate. And that is essentially, and perhaps the finance chairs of the education committees as well. So that's pretty much what the Oversight Committee is. And to tell you the truth, Representative Biskins, until pretty much through last session, last year, I did not realize that we had oversight over this and should be looking into it. And since I discovered that, I have learned a lot about this issue. But we have a ways to go yet. And I will say the DNR has been very helpful, and we have... I think made some progress in what we're going to attempt to do, which you will hear about shortly. We've got some 11th and 12th grade students here, and they are from the academic year in the USA International. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that is, so if you'd like to take 1 second and run down here and tell us a little bit what that is. Is there one of you who would like to do that? The microphone, please. No, you have to be on the microphone. I'm sorry. That's all right. I think when we introduce you, it would be very nice to know who you are. And I think this is the first time I've had this group here, so.
Madam Chairman, my name is Laura Lerwick, and I work with AUSA International, and those letters are an acronym. It stands for Academic Year in the United States of America. These students are particularly a program within a program. They're called the FLEX students, F-L-E-X, which means Future Leaders Exchange. These students are students that were selected out of 45,000 students that applied last year through a government program, or rather scholarship, that's funded by the United States. And of these 45 students, 1,200 of these students came to the United States. We have, I believe, in Minnesota, maybe 9 or 10, maybe 12 of these students residing.
Okay.
They come from the Ukraine, they come from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and from Russia. And they're here for an academic school year. They will be returning home in June, and hopefully they're enjoying their stay. We have one sophomore, three juniors, I believe, and one senior that's attending the schools.
But
we have
you.
Park Center High School, Roosevelt High School, Champlain Park High School, and Coon Rapids High School represented here today.
Okay, thank you so much. That's very interesting, and welcome. I hope you, this is kind of a learning session for all of us on what the permanent school trust lands are, so I'm not sure how exciting this one is for you. Would you proceed, please, Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to, you know, just say that, you know, I didn't mean to insinuate that we did not have school advocates on the Board of Trustees, and in looking at the slide on page 7, where it lists the parties frequently named as trustees, I wouldn't have guessed that the number of education watchdogs that you've listed were part of that, so I thank you for the clarification.
Go ahead, is that Mr. Carroll?
My last slide, which was a perfect segue, was into the net revenue. So that was the last slide. Just again to indicate the revenue that's generated off of the multiple-use sustainable forest management. We go in, we certify costs. The costs are certified for a very detailed process related to fire protection, a variety of different things. We can only certify costs that are pulled potentially back to the general fund. We do not, any federal funding, any bonding dollars, those types of things are not certified as a cost against the trust. So there isn't a further reduction from those dollars. So then the money, then the net revenue goes back into the trust where the board can choose to do with the interest as they so please. So with that, I'll end the brief forestry presentation, but I'll be here for additional questions.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Carroll? Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the criticisms about the forestry management thing in the past is that it you know, when you look at it, and I think someone mentioned $8.6 million of gross, and then almost 5.3 or 6 is taken out for management, and that seems like an awful lot of money that we're not getting, you know, much money from there, you know, that it's much more than 50% that's management costs. Is that typical well, let's say if we had a private management company doing some of this, or I mean, this apparently must be for a lot of staffing of DNR people to manage this, and comments on that?
Madam
Mr.
Chair, Representative, it's an excellent question. We're asked that. It's a very good question. There is a potential, and reviews have been done with the oversight committees and within finance to see if that is an exorbitant charge. And I would say at this point in time, we don't feel it is, because we do certify specific costs and return back as to what we do. And again, the division doesn't reap those dollars. It goes back to the general fund. And if our management is not proper, then the legislative body has the right to turn around and say, well, you're not doing this properly. We're not going to give you the general fund base dollars to do that work. So have there been instances where we've done a formal review of management costs, say, of a private vendor on a property land? I think we have. Those costs have run anywhere from 38 to 52%. The large charge you'll see in a lot of this is based on fire protection. That's a very large charge that a private consultant would not charge you to manage these lands. And again, the other reason why the cost seems charged, of the lands we manage, it all needs fire protection. A lot of the brushy, swampy areas need additional fire protection. That's where the fire starts, burns up to other values. But of the lands we manage, only $1.5 million are actually commercial forests. So the revenue back from a lot of these lands is not, it's not equitable as to how much is produced off of some of these brush lands versus what we charge back for fire. So the large charge is fire. The other fees we feel are very competitive with the private sector. But it's certainly a legitimate question that we're open to that review at all points in time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Segrin.
So when there are no fires in a year, then is that charge, do you see a concurrent reduction in that charge, or is it just you've got a big charge there that's just kind of a charge that you, for anticipated fires, and you just have to carry that cost because you're carrying the staff and the equipment and et cetera that you have to continue?
It is the latter. It is that particular case we have. It's a per acre. It does fluctuate a little bit based on what the actual cost of the fire year is, but it's not a major difference. So it is the latter that you propose. We do have a set fixed allocation based on the need for the prevention structure to be there in case the fire occurs.
So Mr. Carroll, since a lot of our firefighting people, at least that's what I was hearing during the fires in the West, that we had a lot of our people out there fighting fires, does that mean that we would have less costs because they were out there fighting and there'd be some reimbursement to you from other states, or is that not the case?
That is the case. How it shows up in this particular formula, it would not reduce it that much. We're looking at when we have our people go out west, it's during a time period where we're not fighting fires here in Minnesota. But their salaries are paid by the states, the western states, when they are out fighting fire. You look, I mean, rephrase the question if I didn't answer.
No, I think you answered it. The answer was no. We don't benefit from the fact that they were elsewhere. So the trust fund doesn't benefit from that fact. There aren't reduced costs because of that.
I believe there are reduced costs, but I couldn't tell you right particular to the trust fund because it's reducing our overall general fund salary allocation. So it should reduce our, but I will check on that. That's an excellent question.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Heidgerken, did you have another question?
You did very well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biernat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to get into the history of this a little bit more, and maybe Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow would be able to verify this, but you're talking on page 19 here of your summary and talking about that. What ends up happening is income from the school trust is given to the general fund, and in turn it's an offset of what the state spends on education. So it's not really, it doesn't really result in necessarily new money, but it's kind of replacement dollars for what the state would have spent, so that even if we were to enhance the value of this account, all it really would do is back to the policymakers here and in K-12 in terms of how much are we going to spend on education, because isn't it generally an offset? There's no separate fund by which we can identify expenditures to school districts based on this, or is it all lumped together in the appropriation as it says here on page 19?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
What happens is the income from this this land management goes to the school trust fund account. The school trust fund account is invested by the permanent school, the state advisory board. And each year they, at the end of the year, they tell you how much income they receive from that. And that income then goes as a reduction in the amount of money that has to be made up for the school formula. Each school. So if it's, you know, say you spend $300 million on schools and $11 million comes out of the permanent school fund, then the rest of the money has to come out of other sources of state money. So it only comes as an offset.
Representative Biernat.
And just maybe directed to Representative Segrin. So it said it generated about $11 million to $14 million in the last couple of years. Did we get any new money for this, or is it totally just an offset?
Madam Chair,
Representative Segrin.
Representative Biernat, I think it's as you stated, it would just be that was subtracted from the amount that you get. It's not adding to it.
I'm not sure it has to be that way, but that's the way it is at the present time.
The investment board folks are going to speak after we are, but
yes.
Part of it is really related to the investment board and how they manage the assets in the trust.
Now, are there further questions for either of these gentlemen before we go to the investment board?
Let me finish and talk about opportunities.
Oh, sorry.
I need to answer one thing on the fire allocation. In the documentation I will leave, we only charge costs back to the trust based on actual fire occurrence during the year, but there is an assessment back. For example, the charges in 03 were less than 02, which makes sense because 02 was less of a was a larger fire year. But I'll provide detail back to your specific question on how it relates to our salaries and our charges.
Okay, and Representative Greiling had a question on this topic, right?
Sure. No, not yet.
Oh, not yet. Okay. Okay, would you like to go ahead,
sure.
Mr. Bryce?
So if we go, let's talk about the future of the school trust management. Now, this is the school trust land that we're back talking about. And basically the statute in Minnesota Statutes 127A31 sets this up as the goal for the permanent school fund. And basically it says to secure the maximum long-term economic return from the schools, from the school trust lands, consistent with fiduciary responsibilities in the Constitution, with sound natural resource conservation and management principles, and with other specific policy provided in state law. So that's basically the goal under which we manage the school trust lands that was given to us by the legislature. And I believe that was passed in the mid or late 80s when there was some considerable discussion on school trust land management.
Mr. Bryce, has the DNR always managed it, though, or was there something else before that time? Was there another management group or something?
Madam Chair, I don't remember ever hearing of a previous goal. Now there, and when we get to the very last slide here, there's a list of all of the some of the significant studies that have been done, okay. And we certainly have been directed by various studies that have been done over the years. And there was a 1972 study, and then there was another one earlier than that. And obviously, the legislative auditor has been involved, and so on. But this, I think, came out of a 1983 study, and that was the legislative direction that was adopted at that time.
All right, thank you.
So as you've heard, basically these are the kinds of management projects that we do today. We do timber sales, we do mineral leasing of various sorts, we do some land sales, we do a variety of real estate activities, easements, utility crossings, all kinds of things like that, and we do land exchanges. This next slide is these last two slides basically are my issues and my opportunities. These are some of the issues that we have been faced with in the last 4 or 5 years. We talked a little about the boundary waters. We talked a little about the state parks. When the Wetlands Act was passed, I believe in about 91 or 92, there was direction to deal with the peatland scientific and natural areas. We've never been able to deal with that. We continue to have problem with access to our lands as people develop lands around us, or private owners don't want, they want their own private little recreation areas, and so access to state lands is continuing to be a problem because of adjacent landowners, whether it's federal or whatever. The counties, I think, we work with very well, but we do have access issues with other folks. And then there's year after year, there's a constant group of legislative proposals by folks that limit or control the generation of revenue on state trust lands. And that's an issue that we deal with every year, and we try to give you our best judgment about whether a piece of legislation ought to pass or not. But that's just a very common activity, and those are the main issues, I think, that we've dealt with in the last 3 or 4 years. Now, as for the future opportunities, there are other places, and even in Minnesota, where I believe there are activities that have not been seriously looked at as opportunities for managing increasing income in the last decade or so. I believe there are opportunities on expanded leasing. If you look at what's happening in Montana, and Arizona, for example, both of those states have a fairly active commercial industrial leasing program, and they own office buildings and they own industrial parks and other kinds of things. Somebody asked me about whether we ever bought land. There may be some opportunities to buy land that would provide the state trust fund with a substantially more income than maybe we've had in the past. So I think that's a possibility. It ought to be looked at carefully. There are other states who have had experiences with commercial recreation, ski areas. If you go to the west, you'll see lots of ski areas, and some of those occur on federal land, some of them on state land, some of those are trust lands. As an example, there may be some other opportunities there. Agriculture. We have a few agricultural leases. They tend to be small and not very significant sources of income. But if you go to the West, you'll see that agriculture is a much bigger use of state lands on trust fund. State trust fund lands. So that's a possibility. Residential subdivisions. In Utah, they started about 10 or 12 years ago working with developers on residential subdivisions. They lease the land initially, I believe, to the subdivider, and when the lots are sold, the trust fund gets a portion of the income, and the developer gets a portion of the income based on whatever agreement they reach, which is more or less based on how much of the improvements of the developer did versus how much the land was worth. So that's another possibility, and whether we want to do that or not, that would be interesting. that will at least look at that possibility. Aggregate leasing. In recent years, there's a growing demand for aggregates in in many areas of the state, especially in the Twin Cities area. And we believe there's a significant area of income in that area, and we actually have a piece of legislation that we're proposing to allow us to do surveys of some of our sites so that we know how many tons of what kinds of material and what quality are available so that we could be much more active in that area. Land sales. I believe there are... I believe if we had a modest land sale program for trust lands, we could generate I don't know, $500,000 to $1 million a year fairly easily, and that would only take about 20 parcels of land or so a year, which doesn't sound like many when you have something like 25 or 30,000 parcels of land in the school trust. That would be a possibility to look at as a possible income for the school trust lands. Another one is surcharges. You, Representative Sikora, have a bill on the boundary waters for a surcharge to us as an interim approach. In Montana, they have a surcharge on using trust fund land in the license fee for hunting and fishing. If a percentage of the land that's available to the public is trust fund land, and so a certain percentage, a certain portion of that surcharge goes to the school trust for use of that land, that's a possibility of something we could think about. And finally, increased forest productivity. There are always ideas on how we can expand forest productivity and improve the income to the timber sales. So those are just some ideas. I'm sure there are other ideas. I actually had a list of about 50 things. Some of them are absurd, so I decided not to mention those to you. But some of them are quite interesting. It seems like it might be time for some sort of a group to, you know, step back two steps and say, what have we been doing and what are the opportunities out there? And to sort that all out, I think in order to do that, you need a better inventory of the lands we do have. I think we don't know as much about the lands that we have and their potential for income generation, and we ought to look at that. We also are based on the goals that we've been working on. We can handle at DNR about one land exchange a year and about the sale of about 15 or 20 parcels of land a year. Now that's a really small number, and so there's an issue there, I think, of what DNR can actually handle as far as doing some of these management ideas, and we need to look at that. And then finally, I think it might be time to step back kind of two steps and say what ought to be the goals of the of managing and principles of managing the school trust land for the future. And based on those goals, how can we go about trying to accomplish some of those? And I just have a few examples. Obviously, the boundary waters is one major issue that we need to kind of figure out as a state what we ought to do about it. A more general question in my mind is, when should we charge for use of state trust lands and when shouldn't we? I think if you look through history, it's historical. We started by not charging for our own use, and over time we charged a little more. The parks example, we used to put lands in parks all the time, knowing we should take care of that someday in the future. Now we don't put them in up front. So there's those kinds of things. I think the issue of when is an exchange a good idea and when isn't it needs to be looked at. The Hill Annex, I don't think exchanging the school trust lands out of there makes any sense, but we ought to have a management plan for the Hill Annex mine so that we can earn income. We have a stockpile there that's worth maybe, aggregate material is going for $1 a yard. So it has many millions of yards in it, and if we could, cubic yards of material in it, if you could sell it for $1 a yard, you could make $1 million a year at 1 million yards a year, for example. We aren't doing that at the moment, but we're working towards doing that. And then finally, people have asked us, we were required a few years ago to exchange lakeshore that were lakeshore leases. And so we received a bunch of land, all of it lakeshore. And in my mind, it seems like we ought to step back two steps and say, so what should we do with it? At this point, we haven't done a great deal with it other than putting it into our management barrel of management opportunities and treat it like other trust fund land. So those are just some of the things I think that it would be fruitful to talk more about and to try to look towards the future on. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Siegel. Whoops. Representative Greiling is ahead of you, and then Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the surcharges and this, I guess we're going to get later to the specific legislation, but just generally speaking, do these surcharges enhance the revenue available for education, or is that in the category also of displacing other more general funds?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bryce.
Representative, what you have to do is the legislature has to decide whether it should go directly to the trust fund or whether it should go to the forestry suspense account. And right now the policy is that certain leases and easements go to the forest suspense account, campground, and forest income and gravel. Okay, so it would depend on what the legislature decided. If the surcharge went directly to the trust fund, such as minerals and land sales, then you know that would be another option. So it's kind of a decision the legislature should make.
Representative Groening.
Madam Chair, well, if that were the option, then the last scenario you just laid out, would it be enhanced money, though, for education to spend, or would it just displace the other general fund dollars and free up those?
Well, here in Minnesota...
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Here in Minnesota, the trust fund has always displaced other money. In other states, the trust fund has been used for either specific purposes or has been used as an add-on in some cases. And I don't know exactly which states do what, but I know that there's one state that supports libraries, and there's a very real, something happening that there's a constituent base for. And when you have a constituent base and you have interest in increasing the income or managing it differently and so on. So I think those are issues that could be looked at.
Representative Segrin.
Madam Chair, and kind of following along Representative Greiling's line, I think a little bit, if we looked at aggregate leasing, that would be kind of like a mineral. I'm thinking a mineral type of thing, too. So what you're saying is right now the DNR is not pursuing that as a possibility, but we would need to, legislatively, if we wanted to designate that lease revenue would come into the permanent school trust fund, we'd have to legislatively direct that, correct? That, you know, if you started doing that and managing it as the DNR, that it wouldn't necessarily go into the school trust fund, or just a portion of it would go in?
Madam Chair, Representative...
Mr. Bryce.
What we're trying to do on aggregates, and we've been doing a little bit of it, and we would like to increase that program, is to put some money aside so we can do some upfront evaluation of the reserves and the quality of those reserves so we have a better idea of what we ought to be leasing those for. Now, right now, the income from aggregate leasing goes into the forest suspense account, and that's a legislative decision. The reason for that is aggregates are considered to be a surface interest, and taconite and other things are considered to be a mineral interest. And based on the way the statutes are currently organized, surface interests go into the forest suspense account and mineral interests go directly to the trust fund.
So, okay. So, in other words, Madam Chair, that's not a designated, even if it was on a school trust fund, if there was aggregate potential, unless we designate that legislatively, the school trust fund would not get any of that profit, any of that revenue?
Yeah.
Madam Chair...
Mr. Price.
Then they would get the portion of the income that was not certified for forest management. So when you look at it, goes into the between the gross and the net under forest net revenue, basically, and that's where the aggregate goes currently. You can see that on page 11. If you look at page 10, you can see these are the revenue for surface lease contracts, and and these are all the all revenues that, for the most part, go to the forest expense. And that's because forest management was always considered to be a surface management, and mineral management was always considered to be subsurface. And aggregates, and when you look at mineral ownership, aggregates have always been considered to be owned by the surface owner.
But, Madam Chair, I'm kind of following this, though. If you did designate it as a subsurface, then we would probably have much more revenue stream than we do if it went into the forestry account. Would that be a correct assumption?
Mr. Bryce?
Not necessarily. They certify their forest costs, and whatever the difference is, what goes is the net. And I presume that there are very little aggregate surface costs that they're certifying.
Very little.
And so most of the aggregate money that's going in the forest expense account is just going there and making a short stop and then heading towards the trust fund. However, if you did it the other way, you would be able to actually see the numbers. And you would be able to, you would know exactly how much was going from one to the other. Whereas it kind of gets mixed up with a lot of the other money in the forest expense.
Madam Chair.
Representative Segrin.
I guess where I'm trying to take that is there's probably not as much management of aggregate. You're having a private company coming in and basically mining the aggregate, and they're bearing the cost of doing that and making their profit, so that we're not absorbing so much expenditure. And thus, we should be able to get a bigger share of the aggregate revenue than if we would have it, if we had it just kind of all mingled in with the Forest Reserve account. I guess that's where I'm going with that.
Mr. Price.
Madam Chair, Representative, what really happens in lands and minerals is that the general fund appropriates funding and doesn't take money out of the trust fund revenues to support that management. And in forestry, general revenue also supports it, but they get partially reimbursed because of the money they take out of the forest expense account. So right now, the state policy is really what we're talking about. The state policy has been that for most lands and minerals things, they go directly to the account, and for forestry things, they go through the expense account, and a portion of it gets cycled through the general fund.
Just to clarify, Mr. Bryce, when somebody leases a piece of land for the purpose of extracting aggregate from it, and we do have rules and regulations on restoration of that land after they complete it, are we billed for that, or is that just part of their costs, et cetera?
Madam Chair, what we do in our leases is we require a reclamation plan to be included in their costs.
Okay.
So when we sell it so much per yard or so much per ton, and we get that regardless of what their reclamation costs are. But we do also require them to do reclamation.
All right. Thank you. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, following up on Representative Segrim's comments and Representative Sikora's, I still have a difficulty of understanding exactly how the money is all earmarked depending upon what fund it comes out of, if it's aggregate or if it's land sales, if it's what. But I see this as a possibility, as a good revenue stream for the school, so I'm going to go back to the overall general picture and get away from the details. As far as I can figure out, about 40% of the funds go in R and 60% has been going to the schools. Am I correct on that assumption?
Mr.
Bryce.
I think you're correct. In fiscal year 03, it was a gross income of 17.6. And the amount that went to the trust fund was 11.6, so that sounds about right.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern here is that I know we appropriate funds for the DNR through the Environment Bill, and I know that there's lottery funds also going into the DNR. My concern is here is that there may be some doubling up. And Representative Holstein might be able to comment on that, but I see a lot of money that normally is never discussed when we talk about the Environment Bill or the lottery that never comes up. and this is one area that I've never seen addressed. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Commissioner Holston.
Representative Hagerkin. I think we've got a misconnect here right now. The general fund covers the virtually all of the forestry division's activities. At the end of the year, they go in and they certify their costs associated to the management activity that took place on that trust fund land. So when we send a forester out to look at a section of land and he's doing his management work on there, if half of that land was school trust fund, he would bill those costs back to the trust fund. And then we would go in and certify those costs. That trust fund then reimburses the general fund. It doesn't come to the Department of Natural Resources. So the department only gets it once. Gets that dollar of management one time. We certify those costs associated to managing the trust fund or managing the trust lands. Then the trust fund suspense account reimburses the general fund. As it relates to the lottery, the Department of Natural Resources doesn't get very much of that money. Most of that money is passed throughout to different entities. It may come through the DNR, but the DNR is a manager of those dollars as it transfers those dollars out. So the Department of Natural Resources doesn't get lottery dollars for management purposes.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Okay, this might not be the right place for the. So in other words, you can tell me that the money that the appropriations bill we did for the environment, that none of the monies that we appropriated there for the DNR went to the maintenance or the supervision of the trust lands.
Oh, Madam Chair,
Mr. Holston,
Representative Heiger, and I can virtually guarantee that. I won't 100% guarantee that, but there may have been elements of bills that were used, or some of those dollars that the department may have used for something that happened on the trust fund land, but not for the management. We are prevented. The legislature, when it created the distribution for the lottery funds, and that would be in, I can't remember what section of law the trust fund is in, but those dollars are only to supplement dollars that the agency would be using. I'd have to go back and take a real close look at how those trust fund dollars in the last year were allocated into the agency for what particular purposes. And I can demonstrate and show you exactly where those are.
Thank you.
Members, we want to still hear from the State Board of Investment today on how they're managing our lands and how we're doing compared to other things. But did you want to ask your question, Representative? Representative Carlson's had another question.
Madam Chair, I think this can be fairly quick because I know you want to move along on the agenda, but do you manage the lands held by the University of Minnesota? I thought I recalled that you did, and my question is, are they, relative to some of the things you've been talking about here with the school trust lands, do you have the same kind of arrangements with the University of Minnesota?
Madam Mr. Price.
Representative, but we manage the university trust fund lands in the similar way that we manage the school trust lands. Now, the amount of university trust fund lands is much smaller. And so the main source, they're just lucky. They have a fairly large income because of a few 40s over at National Steel. And so if you look at their annual income, it's like $7 or $8 million right now on a really small portion of land. But it's yes, we manage them the same way, the minerals, the forests, and so on. And we send the money to them for the permanent university trust fund. And then, of course, it's dedicated to scholarships and mineral research.
And so, Madam Chair, the net?
Mr. Carlson, Representative Carlson.
Because they have iron ore, is that what you're referring to? Is that the difference is on that income? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
They have most of the permanent university trust lands were sold, and so there's relatively few of them. And it just happens that two of their tracts of land, one was at LTV Steel and one was at National Steel, which is now part of called KeyTech. It's part of U.S. Steel's properties. And so they're making a large amount of money on a few 40s over at National Steel. If you think of 40 million tons of ore on a 40, they're making something like 15 or 20 million per 40 over a long period of time. So they're doing really well at the moment on minerals. As long as National continues to operate, they were in bankruptcy recently. They're out.
Thank you.
Isn't that nice for the university? Somehow, some of those new mineral leases have to do that for us. I want to thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to get to Mr. Heidelberg. Thank you very much. What we're going to do, we have two bills, folks, which we won't expect a vote on today, but I'd like you to take a look at them. One of them is really a resolution because we have to go through Congress in order to get a very small fee for people who are going into the BWCA. So we have to go through Congress for that, and we're asking for that, plus then to pursue a final solution for the fact that they never paid us for the Boundary Waters canoe acres. All 87,000 acres have never been paid for. And so we think it's maybe time after 20 years to see something from that. The other one we have is a proposal that we do some aggregate exploration, and that would cost us a little money, but I think it will bring in money in the future as we do it. But those are things for you to look at. We will vote on another day. Mr. Heidelberg. Representative Latz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a technical question. The staff overview cites 93,000 acres of school trust fund land within the BWCA, and the bill says 87,000. Are they comparable numbers, and is one be corrected?
Mr. Strom, do you want to comment on that? To tell you the truth, there doesn't seem to be any sure final exact number, but it's somewhere between 87 and 93,000. It's 87? Okay. I know I have been using 93,000 for a period of time, and that's the number I saw in the report from 2 years ago, but apparently that was a little off. Mr. Heidelberg, thank you so much for being here. We're very eager to hear what's happening with the permanent trust lands and how our investment is doing compared to the Standard & Poor's or anything else you'd like to compare it to. Please proceed.
My name is Jim Heidelberg. I'm the manager of public programs for the State Board of Investment. We invest the principal of the trust fund. We don't invest trust fund lands. The proceeds, the revenues, the cash proceeds from the DNR activities about which you just heard are deposited as principal into the fund, and it is that principal that we invest on an ongoing basis. The spendable income earned from the trust fund that we invest is used to offset school aids in the budget. As of June 30th, 2003, the market value of the fund was $527 million. The state board invests this permanent school fund to grow it over time. Currently, the fund is invested 50% in domestic equities and 50% in fixed income. The assets are invested in non-retirement funds that we have available that are invested by State Board of Investment staff. They are separate from the retirement assets that we invest. At the bottom of the second page, there's a chart that shows the spendable income that's been generated by the trust fund, the investment activities over the last five fiscal years. You can see that that sum has fallen off, and that is a result of the bad stock market activity and the low interest rates that we have encountered over the last several periods. The trust fund is again invested half in equities and half in bonds, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to try to address them.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, if you would care to, I was involved, as you may remember, when we changed the way we were approaching the investments, and we were looking at it long term and shifting more into the stock side of the equation was kind of the bottom line. Can you give us your assessment now? Did we do the right thing? Would we be better off if we would have remained with the old formula, which was more fixed investments? I remember going back, we had charts going back to like 1920 in terms of where we would have been had we had a broader portfolio, let me put it that way, and looking for your advice as we go to the future.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Heidelberg,
what you're referring to is the action taken in the 97 session, I believe it was, Representative, in which the State Board worked with various members of the legislature and with the Department of Finance. Prior to fiscal year 98, the fund was invested in entirely in fixed income, which generated higher spendable income. Interest off bonds is higher than the income that you get from stocks, which are dividends. And the issue was to try to grow the fund over time, to have a larger fund in the future, to therefore generate larger spendable income. But by moving from bonds to stocks, we would reduce the income. So there was a budget impact. So at that time, during the 97 session, monies were set aside as, I'm not quite sure I'm using the right budgetary phrases here, but a recognition in the budget that the offset to school aids was going to be smaller with a move into equities. And we have been investing in equities at a 50-50 split since fiscal year 98. The fund has grown since then. I don't have the numbers in front of me. We can check and get those for you, Representative. The funds grew nicely in fiscal years 98 through, I believe, 2000. Bad markets for a number of periods there, but the market has come back in 2003. The fund has actually earned 8.0% from July through December of calendar 2003. So clearly moving into stocks has helped, but it will be a choppy ride from year to year.
Madam Chair, my question is essentially, was you sound as though you're still comfortable with the 97 decision and to divide the investment.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, to the extent that the legislature is comfortable with that, we would be more than happy to discuss that if you show the interest.
Madam Chair, I for one, am comfortable when I look at it the long term, the information you had for us in 97. Just was soliciting your thoughts to see if they were the same as mine. Thank you.
So I guess the nut of it is that in the short term, we've not done real well with it, but for the long term, we're probably better off.
Madam Chair, yes.
All right. Are there other questions for Mr. Heidelberg in this area? Hearing none. Thank you very much. And members, I don't think we have time to walk through the legislation that we have proposed today. So we will have a vote on that for another day. They're both very simple pieces. One of them would allow us to spend $50,000 a year out of the permanent school trust money to do exploration on the aggregate, which the idea being that over the long term we will have a stream of income from that. Each year we'd be able to do three or four explorations with the $50,000 in the bill and end up hopefully with over time a number of areas producing some funds for us.
Madam Chair, do you mean a survey to survey the land or
no? I believe Mr. Bryce, what we were talking about was actually looking at areas where we think there's gravel and doing testing to see if there's aggregate available in those areas. Is that correct? Sorry. You can never get too far away in this committee.
Madam Chair, that's correct. These are basically 40 or 60 acres or whatever of land that we know has a real strong likelihood. It's an area where there are people interested in purchasing aggregate. And we would like to, the quality standards are really important. You can get, you don't get very much for sand, you get a lot more for crystalline aggregate, and so we want to know what's on the site exactly, or as close as we can to before we lease it.
Representative Carlson?
My question is of you.
Oh, all right. Stay there just in case. Yes.
No, this doesn't have a house file number, so is this going to...
No, it hasn't been dropped. I mean, I don't think it has a number yet. I don't know if it was dropped in yet, but this is, mm-hmm. One of the proposals that we came up with when we met as a group back in October, November. Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if it was going to be an amendment or something to another bill or what, being that it didn't have...
No, it will. I just wanted you to, since we were talking about this today, I wanted you to see what...
Some of us were electronically shuttling between here and Bosnia.
Yes.
With the higher ed committee, so...
I know, of all days, the higher ed committee decides to meet in a different building. So that's the way things go.
You may have explained it earlier.
Yes, yes.
So, thank you.
No, I hadn't explained it earlier, but... And then the other one is just really memorializing Congress to begin to attempt to do something with our issue. Could you wait one more minute? I have one other question. You mentioned we're only doing forestry management right now, essentially, and lumbering on 18,000 acres out of our 2 million acres. Are the rest of them, is there no good forestry stock on those lands? Why are we not looking at more of them?
Excellent question, committee members. What I was trying to lay out for you of the 2+ million acres that the Division of Forestry manages, about 1.5 of those are designated as commercial forest lands. Lands where there is good fiber. There's other values there also, but there is good fiber that can be harvested. Of that, we do a 10-year planting sequence. What I'm saying is that on a given year, we're only affecting through direct treatment 18,000 of those acres over a year. But we do have a plan as needed. We will do multiple entries or single entries to not only harvest the fiber but improve the stands for visual and wildlife habitat. So that I was just trying to give you an example of how much is impacted on a yearly basis.
All right. I'm sorry. Maybe everybody else understood that and I didn't, but
no.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. And I think with that, thank you very much, gentlemen. I think for those of us who are here, this was very helpful. There are other committees that meet right now also, so we have a few of our members lost. But thank you, and the meeting is adjourned.